charged in Lawrence, just as it is in Walt Whitman, whom he admired greatly, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, in their very different ways. Indeed, you could argue that the role of the individual is always politically charged, that matters of autonomy and free will and self-determination always drag in the larger society, if only tangentially. Someone like Thomas Pynchon, although, as Chapter 1 suggests, it's not clear there is anyone like Pynchon except Pynchon, who seems on one level to be hiding from the body politic, is profoundly political in his concern over the individual's relationship to America. Or here's someone whose stories you may not have thought of as inevitably political, Edgar Allan Poe. His tales The Mask of the Red Death, 1842, and The Fall of the House of Usher, 1839, both deal with a stratum of society most of us only get to read about, the nobility. In the former, the prince, in the midst of a terrible plague, gathers his friends and associates for a party, at which he locks them away from the afflicted and poor society outside the walls of the palace. The titular scourge finds them anyway, and by morning they're all dead. In the latter, the host, Roderick Usher, and his sister Madeline, are the last survivors of an old aristocratic family. Living in a decaying mansion surrounded by a forbidding landscape, they are themselves decaying. She has a progressive wasting disease, while he is prematurely aged and decrepit, his hair nearly gone and his nerves shot. He behaves, moreover, like a madman, and there is more than a slight hint at incestuous closeness between brother and sister. In both of these tales, Poe offers criticism of the European class system, which privileges the unworthy and the unhealthy, where the entire atmosphere is corrupt and decaying, where the results are madness and death. The landscape of Usher resembles no part of America Poe ever saw. Even the appellation House of Usher suggests European monarchy and aristocracy, the houses of Bourbon or Hanover, for instance, rather than an American place or family. Roderick has buried his sister alive, possibly knowing she wasn't dead, certainly becoming aware of it as time in the story passes. Now, why would he do a thing like that? When she escapes, having clawed her way out, she falls into his arms and they collapse to the floor, both dead. The narrator narrowly escapes before the house itself pulls apart and crashes into the black and lurid tarn at its base. If all of that doesn't suggest an unhealthy, unholy, and distinctly un-American relationship between brother and sister, then one of us is missing something. Edgar Allan Poe, super patriot? Okay, you're right. That may be going too far. Still, he implicitly believes that what Europe represents is degraded and decaying, and these are not the only examples. Moreover, Poe suggests strongly that this is the inevitable and even just outcome of a corrupt social organization. And that, dear friends, is political. Ready for another example? How about Rip Van Winkle? I'm sure you have doubts. Tell me what you remember. Okay. Rip Van Winkle, who's lazy and not a great provider for his family, goes hunting. Actually, he's really just getting away from his nagging wife. He meets some odd characters playing ninepins, with whom he drinks a little bit and falls asleep. When he wakes up, his dog is gone, and his gun has rusted and fallen apart. He has white hair and a beard a mile long and very stiff joints. He makes his way back to town and finds out he's been asleep for 20 years, and his wife is dead and everything has changed, including the signs at the hotel. And that's pretty much the story. Pretty much. Nothing very political in that, right? Except that we need to consider two questions. One, what does it mean that Dame Van Winkle is dead? Two, how does that connect with the change of George's on the hotel sign? During the 20 years he's been away, the American Revolution has happened. The picture of British King George has been transformed by the proprietors into that of our George, Washington, although with the same face. There's a liberty cap atop the flagpole, which carries a new flag, and the tyrant, Dame Van Winkle is dead. Rip nearly gets attacked when he says he's loyal to the old George, but once that gets straightened out, he finds out he's free and he likes it. So, everything's better? Definitely not. Irving is writing in 1819 and is observant enough to know that liberty brought with it some problems. Things have become a little run down. The hotel has some broken windows and needs a facelift, and the town and its people are generally a little more ragged than they were before the war. But there's a kind of energy that drives them, a certainty that their lives are their own, and nobody, by golly, is going to boss them around. They speak their minds and do what they want. And tyranny and absolute rule are dead. In other words, this slightly scruffy assemblage of people is on the way to defining for itself what it means to be American and free. So not everything is better, but the things that really matter, freedom, self-determination, they are better. How can I be so sure that Irving means to imply all that? Part of his protective coloration is as this rather naive, rustic spinner of tales, but that's not him. It's pure disguise. Washington Irving was a man of great sophistication who studied law, was admitted to the bar, served in Spain as a diplomat, wrote histories as well as fiction, traveled widely. Does that sound like a man who didn't understand what his narrative signified? His ostensible narrator, Diedrich Knickerbocker, is a jolly companion who spins out these tales of his Dutch ancestors without seeing all the implications. Irving saw them, though. He knew, moreover, that with Rip and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, 1819, he was creating an American consciousness in literature, a thing that hadn't existed prior to his time. Like Poe, he sets himself up in opposition to European literary tradition, offering instead a body of work that could only come from an American, and that features and celebrates freedom from its former colonial power. So is every literary work political? I can't go that far. Some of my more political colleagues may tell you, yes, that every work is either part of the social problem or part of the solution. They'll give it to you with rather more subtlety than that, but that's the gist. I do think, though, that most works must engage with their own specific period in ways that can be called political. Let's say this. Writers tend to be men and women who are interested in the world around them. That world contains many things, and on the level of society, part of what it contains is the political reality of the time. Power structures, relations among classes, issues of justice and rights, interactions between the sexes and among various racial and ethnic constituencies. That's why political and social considerations often find their way onto the page in some guise, even when the result doesn't look terribly political. An example. When Sophocles is a very old man, he finally writes the middle third of his Theban trilogy of plays, Oedipus at Colonus, 406 BC, in which the old and frail Oedipus arrives at Colonus and receives the protection of the Athenian king, Theseus. Theseus is everything we might want in a ruler. Strong, wise, gentle, tough when necessary, determined, cool-headed, compassionate, loyal, honest. Theseus protects Oedipus from potential harm and guides him to the sacred spot where the old man is fated to die. Is that political? I think so. You see, Sophocles is writing this not only at the end of his life, but at the end of the 5th century BC, which is to say at the end of the period of Athenian greatness. The city-state is threatened from the outside by Spartan aggression and from the inside by leaders who, whatever their virtues, sure aren't Theseus. What he's saying is, in effect, we could really use a leader like Theseus again. Maybe he could get us out of this mess and keep Athens from total ruin. Then outsiders, Creon in the play, the Spartans in reality, wouldn't be trying to overrun us. Then we'd still be strong and just and wise. Does Sophocles actually say any of these things? No, of course not. He's old, not senile. You say these things openly, they give you hemlock or something. He doesn't have to say them, though. Everyone who sees the play can draw his own conclusions. Look at Theseus. Look at whatever leader you have near to hand. Look at Theseus again. Or words to that effect. See? Political. All this matters. Knowing a little something about the social and political milieu out of which a writer creates can only help us understand her work, not because that milieu controls her thinking, but because that is the world she engages when she sits down to write. When Virginia Woolf writes about women of her time only being permitted a certain range of activities, we do her and ourselves a great disservice by not seeing the social criticism involved. For instance, in Mrs. Dalloway, 1925, Lady Bruton invites Richard Dalloway, a member of Parliament, and Hugh Whitbread, who has a position at court, to luncheon. Her purpose is to dictate to them material she wants to see introduced into legislation and sent as a letter to the Times, all the while protesting that she's merely a woman who doesn't understand these matters as a man would. What Woolf shows us is a very capable, if not entirely lovable, woman using the fairly limited Richard and the completely doltish Hugh to make her point in a society which would not take the point seriously if it was seen as coming directly from her. In the years after the Great War, the scene reminds us, ideas were judged on the basis of the class and gender of the person putting them forward. Woolf handles all of this so subtly that we may not think of it as political, but it is. It always, or almost always, is. Chapter 14. Yes, she's a Christ figure too. This may surprise some of you, but we live in a Christian culture. What I mean is that since the preponderance of cultural influences has come down to us from European early settlers, and since those early settlers inflicted their values on the benighted cultures they encountered, benighted from the Old English meaning anyone darker than myself, those inflicted values have gained ascendancy. This is not to say that all citizens of this great republic are Christians, any more than that they are all great republicans. I once heard a well-known Jewish professor of composition speak about walking into her very first final examination in college only to be confronted with this question: discuss the Christian imagery in Billy Budd. It simply never occurred to her professor back in the 1950s that Christian imagery might be alien territory for some students. Institutions of higher learning can no longer blithely assume that everyone in class is a Christian, and if they do, it's at their own risk. Still, no matter what your religious beliefs, to get the most out of your reading of European and American literatures, knowing something about the Old and New Testaments is essential. Similarly, if you undertake to read literature from an Islamic or a Buddhist or a Hindu culture, you're going to need knowledge of other religious traditions. Culture is so influenced by its dominant religious systems that whether a writer adheres to the beliefs or not, the values and principles of those religions will inevitably inform the literary work. Often those values will not be religious in nature, but may show themselves in connection with the individual's role within society, or humankind's relation to nature, or the involvement of women in public life. Although, as we have seen, just as often, religion shows up in the form of allusions and analogues. When I read an Indian novel, for example, I'm often aware, if only dimly, of how much I'm missing due to my ignorance of the various religious traditions of the subcontinent. Since I'd like to get more out of my reading, I've worked to reduce that ignorance, but I still have a way to go. Okay, so not everyone is a Christian around these parts, nor do those who would say they are necessarily have more than a nodding familiarity with the New Testament, aside from John 3:16, which is always beside the goalposts at football games. But in all probability, they do know one thing. They know why it's called Christianity. Okay, so it's not the most profound insight ever, but it matters. A lot. Northrop Frye, one of the great literary critics, said in the 1950s that biblical typology, the comparative study of types between the Old and New Testaments, and by extension out into literature, was a dead language, and things haven't improved since then. While we may not be all that well-versed in types and archetypes from the Bible, we generally recognize, whatever our religious affiliation, some of the features that make Christ who he is. Whether you do or not, this list may be helpful. 1. Crucify. Wounds in the hands, feet, side, and head. 2. In agony. 3. Self-sacrificing. 4. Good with children. 5. Good with loaves, fishes, water, wine. 6. 33 years of age when last seen. 7. Employed as carpenter. 8. Known to use humble modes of transportation, feet or donkeys preferred. 9. Believed to have walked on water. 10. Often portrayed with arms outstretched. 11. Known to have spent time alone in the wilderness. 12. Believed to have had a confrontation with the devil, possibly tempted. 13. Last seen in the company of thieves. 14. Creator of many aphorisms and parables. 15. Buried, but arose on the third day. 16. Had disciples, 12 at first, although not all equally devoted. 17. Very forgiving. 18. Came to redeem an unworthy world. You may not subscribe to this list, may find it too glib, but if you want to read like a literature professor, you need to put aside your belief system, at least for the period during which you read, so you can see what the writer is trying to say. As you're reading that story or poem, religious knowledge is helpful, although religious belief, if too tightly held, can be a problem. We want to be able to identify features in stories and see how they are being used. In other words, we want to be analytical. Say we're reading a book, a novel, short novel, say, and let's say this short novel has a man in it, a man no longer young, in fact old, as well as very poor and engaged in a humble profession. Not carpentry, say, but fishing. Jesus had some dealings with fishermen, too, and is often connected symbolically with fish. So that's a point of similarity, and the old fisherman hasn't had much good luck for a long time, so no one believes in him. In general, there's a lot of doubt and non-belief in our story. But one young boy believes in him. Sadly, though, the boy isn't allowed to accompany the fisherman anymore, because everyone, the boy's parents included, think the old man is bad luck. There's a second point of similarity. He's good with children, or at least one child. And he has one disciple. And this old man is very good and pure. So that's another point. Because the world he lives in is rather sullied and unworthy. Fallen, even. During his solitary fishing trip, the old man hooks into a big fish that takes him far out beyond his known limits, to where the sea becomes a wilderness. He's all alone, and he's put through great physical suffering, during which even he begins to doubt himself. His hands are ripped up by the struggle. He thinks he's broken something in his side. But he bucks himself up with aphorisms like, "A man is not made for defeat. A man can be destroyed, but not defeated." Inspiring things like that. Somehow he can endure this whole episode, which lasts 3 days, and which finally makes it seem to those on land that he's dead. His great fish is ruined by sharks, but he manages to drag this huge, ruined skeleton back to port. His return is like a resurrection. He has to walk up a hill from the water to his shack, and he carries his mast, which looks like a man carrying a cross from a certain point of view. Then he lies on his bed, exhausted by his struggles, his arms thrown out in the position of crucifixion, showing his damaged, raw hands. And the next morning, when people see the great fish, even the doubters begin to believe in him again. He brings a kind of hope, a kind of redemption to this fallen world, and... yes? Didn't Hemingway write a book like that? Yes. The Old Man and the Sea, 1952. A nearly perfect literary parable, so clear, with symbols so available, that the Christian imagery is accessible to even beginning readers. But let's give old Hemingway some credit here. The narrative is more subtle than I've just made it sound. And the struggle is so vivid and concrete that one can get a lot out of it. Triumph over adversity, the value of hope and faith, the attainment of grace, without placing undue weight on the old man, Santiago, as a Christ figure. So must all Christ figures be as unambiguous as this? No, they don't have to hit all the marks. Don't have to be male, don't have to be Christian, don't even have to be good. See the stories of Flannery O'Connor, for example after example. There, however, we're starting to get into irony, and that's a whole different area where I don't want to go just yet. Yet. But if a character is a certain age, exhibits certain behaviors, provides for certain outcomes, or suffers in certain ways, your literary antennae should begin to twitch. How should we know, though? Here's a handy list, not all-inclusive, but a start. You might be a Christ figure if you are, check any that apply, 33 years old, unmarried, preferably celibate, wounded or marked in the hands, feet, or side, crown of thorns, extra credit, sacrificing yourself in some way for others. Your life is best, and your sacrifice doesn't have to be willing. In some sort of wilderness, tempted there, accosted by the devil. Oh, you get the point. Consult previous list. Are there things you don't have to do? Certainly. Consider Santiago again. Wait, you say, shouldn't he be 33? And the answer is, sometimes that's good. But a Christ figure doesn't need to resemble Christ in every way. Otherwise, he wouldn't be a Christ figure. He'd be, well, Christ. The literal elements, changing water into wine, unless in some clumsy way, such as pouring out someone's water and filling his glass with wine, stretching loaves and fishes to feed 5,000, preaching, although some do, suffering actual crucifixion, literally following in his footsteps, aren't really required. It's the symbolic level we're interested in. Which brings us to another issue we've touched upon in other chapters. Fiction and poetry and drama are not necessarily playgrounds for the overly literal. Many times I'll point out that a character is Christ-like because he does X and Y, and you might come back with, but Christ did A and Z, and his X wasn't like that, and besides, this character listens to AC/DC. Okay, so the heavy metal sound isn't in the hymnal, and this character would be very hard-pressed to take over savior duty. No literary Christ figure can ever be as pure, as perfect, as divine as Jesus Christ. Here, as elsewhere, one does well to remember that writing literature is an exercise of the imagination, and so is reading it. We have to bring our imaginations to bear on a story if we are to see all its possibilities. Otherwise, it's just about somebody who did something. Whatever we take away from stories in the way of significance, symbolism, theme, meaning, pretty much anything except character and plot, we discover because our imagination engages with that of the author. Pretty amazing when you consider that the author may have been dead for 1,000 years, yet we can still have this kind of exchange, this dialogue with her. At the same time, this doesn't indicate the story can mean anything we want it to, since that would be a case of our imagination not bothering with that of the author and just inventing whatever it wants to see in the text. That's not reading. That's writing. But that's another matter, and one we'll discuss elsewhere. On the flip side, if someone in class asks if it's possible that the character under discussion might be a Christ figure, citing 3 or 4 similarities, I'll say something like, works for me. The bottom line, I usually tell the class, is that Christ figures are where you find them, and as you find them. If the indicators are there, then there is some basis for drawing the conclusion. Why, you might ask, are there Christ figures? As with most other cases we've looked at where the work engages some prior text, the short answer is that probably the writer wants to make a certain point. Perhaps the parallel deepens our sense of the character's sacrifice if we see it as somehow similar to the greatest sacrifice we know of. Maybe it has to do with redemption, or hope, or miracle. Or maybe it is all being treated ironically, to make the character look smaller rather than greater. But count on it, the writer is up to something. How do we know what he's up to? That's another job for imagination. Chapter 15. Flights of Fancy. I took just enough physics in school to master one significant fact. Human beings cannot fly. Here's a principle that always holds. If it flies, it isn't human. Birds fly, bats fly, insects sometimes fly. Certain squirrels and fish sail for a bit and seem to fly. Humans? 32 feet per second squared. Same as bowling balls. If you drop me and a bowling ball off the Tower of Pisa, and please don't, at the same time, the bowling ball won't go splat. Otherwise, we're the same. Airplanes? No doubt about it. Airplanes and blimps and helicopters and autogyros have changed the way we perceive flight. But for almost all of human history, we've been earthbound. Meaning what? Meaning that when we see a person suspended in the air, even briefly, he is one or more of the following. 1. A superhero. 2. A ski jumper. 3. Crazy. Redundant if also number 2. 4. Fictional. 5. A circus act, departing a canon. 6. Suspended on wires. 7. An angel. 8. Heavily symbolic. Of course, just because we can't fly doesn't mean we don't dream of it. We chafe at laws, particularly when we feel they're unfair or inhibiting or both, as with a law of gravity. The steady winner in magic acts, since most magicians can't afford an elephant for the vanishing act, is levitation. British imperialists in the 19th century came back from the eastern realms with tales of swamis who had mastered the art of hovering above the ground. Our comic book superheroes defy gravity in various ways, whether through flight directly, Superman, tethers, Spider-Man, or gadgets, Batman. Culturally and literarily, we have toyed with the idea of flight since earliest times. Few stories from Greek mythology capture the imagination like that of Daedalus and Icarus, the ingenious father's attempt to save his son from a tyrant, as well as from his own invention, the labyrinth, by coming up with an even more marvelous creation, the solemn parental warning ignored in a burst of youthful exuberance, the fall from a great height, a father's terrible grief and guilt. Flight alone is a wonder, with these other elements, a complete and compelling myth. Other cultures share this fascination. Toni Morrison has spoken of the myth of the flying Africans. The Aztecs saw a particularly important god, Quetzalcoatl, as a snake with feathered wings. Christian popular belief often sees new arrivals in heaven decked out with wings and a harp, emblems of flight and music which are natural properties of the birds, but denied humans. Scripturally, flight is one of the temptations of Christ. Satan asks him to demonstrate his divinity by launching himself from the promontory. Perhaps it is that episode that has associated witchcraft with flight through so much of our history. Or perhaps it is merely that our misplaced desire for flight has turned to envy. So what does it mean when literary characters fly? Take, for example, Morrison's Song of Solomon and its highly ambiguous airborne ending, with milkmen suspended in mid-leap toward guitar, each of them knowing only one can survive. Morrison's use of the myth of the flying Africans introduces a specific historical and racial reference that is outside the experience of most readers, but we recognize various implications. Milkman's great-grandfather, Solomon, flew off to Africa, but couldn't hold on to his youngest child, Jake, dropping him back to earth and slavery. Flying off in this instance suggests casting off the chains of slavery on one level, and returning home, Africa for Solomon, Virginia for Milkman, on another. In general, flying is freedom, we might say. Freedom not only from specific circumstances, but from those more general burdens that tie us down. It's escape, the flight of imagination. All of this is very good. Well then, what about Pilot, Milkman's unfortunately named aunt? After she dies, a bird swoops down, grabs the earring box containing a slip of paper with her name on it, and flies away. Milkman suddenly realizes that of all the people he's ever known, Pilot alone had the power of flight, even though she never left the ground. What does it mean to say that someone who remains physically earthbound has been able to fly? It's spiritual, we might conclude. Her soul could soar, which you can't say about anybody else in the novel. She is the character of spirit and love. Her last utterance is a wish that she could have known more people, so she could have loved them all. Such a character is not anchored at all. She's flying in a way we don't need to know the underlying myth of the flying Africans to comprehend. So freedom, escape, return home, largeness of spirit, love. That's a lot for just one work to do with flying. What about others? What about E.T.? When those bicycles leave the street in the Steven Spielberg classic, what's the situation? The adults of the community, representing conformity, hostility to anything new, xenophobia, suspicion, a lack of imagination, are bearing down on our young heroes. They've even set up a roadblock. At just the moment when things look worst, the bicycles leave the earth and, with it, the earthbound grown-ups. Escape? Certainly. Freedom? You bet. Wonder? Magic? Absolutely. It's really pretty straightforward. Flight is freedom. It doesn't always work out that way, but the basic principle is pretty sound. Angela Carter's Nights at the Circus, 1984, offers a comparative rarity, a fictional character who actually possesses wings. Carter's heroine, Fevers, whose name paradoxically suggests both feathers and tethers, is a woman whose flying act has made her the toast of circuses and music halls across Europe. It has also set her apart. She is not like other people, cannot comfortably fit into normal human life. Carter's use of flight differs from Morrison's in that it does not emphasize freedom and escape. Like Franz Kafka's Hunger Artist, Fevers has a gift that places her in a cage. Her flights are contained indoors. Her world is a stage where even the fourth wall is a barrier, since she is so different from her audience that she cannot freely join them. There are a couple of points that should be made here. First, as I have intimated several times before and will discuss later, irony trumps everything. But irony typically depends on an established pattern on which it can work its inversions. All of Carter's irony here, naturally enough, builds on a foundation of expectations having to do with flying and wings. If flying is freedom, and if Fevers' flying represents a kind of counter-freedom, then we have an inversion that creates significance. She's trapped by the ability most symbolic of freedom. Without our expectations about the meaning of flight, Fevers is simply an oddity on a stage. The second point has to do with different kinds of freedom. Just as Morrison's pilot can fly without ever leaving the ground, so Fevers can find freedom even within the limitations of her fishbowl world. Her act frees her to express her sexuality in ways not available to other women in the novel's highly restricted late Victorian society. She can dress, speak, and act in a manner that would be deeply shocking in other contexts. Her freedom, like her imprisonment, is paradoxical. Carter uses Fevers with her mix of earthy sexuality and avian ability to comment on the situation of women in English society. It's a strategy that is perfectly normal for Carter, whose novels typically and comically undercut assumptions about masculine and feminine roles, holding up our received notions for scrutiny and occasional ridicule. Social criticism is the outcome of this subversive strategy. Flight, the device by which Carter sets up her ironic notions of freedom and imprisonment. Characters like Fevers, who possess wings, are particularly interesting to us. And why not? How many of your friends and neighbors sport feathers? In truth, stories with winged characters make up a pretty small genre, but those few stories hold a special fascination. Gabriel Garcia Marquez's story, A Very Old Man with Enormous Wings, 1968, features a nameless old man who falls from the sky during a monsoonal rain. His wings are indeed enormous. Some of the poor people in the coastal Colombian town where he lands take him to be an angel, but if he is, he's a very odd one. He's dirty and smelly, and his ragged wings harbor parasites. It is true that shortly after he plops down in the yard of Paleo and Elisanda, their child recovers from a life-threatening fever. But his other miracles, if he has anything to do with them, don't work exactly right. One character fails to recover health but nearly wins the lottery, while another, although not cured of leprosy, sprouts sunflowers from his sores. Still, the residents are fascinated by this new arrival, so much so that the peasant couple constructs a cage and puts him on display. Although the old man does nothing remarkable, so many people come and pay the small admission fee that Paleo and Elisanda become wealthy. We never know what the old man is, and speculation among the townspeople is hilarious as well as occasionally bizarre. His green eyes suggest to one character that he's a Norwegian sailor, but his hapless, shabby appearance and long-suffering silence clearly benefit the family in a nearly miraculous fashion. In the way of those who receive miraculous aid, they are unappreciative and even a little resentful at having to provide for the old man. Eventually, the old man regains his strength and, seen only by the wife, flaps away, his ungainly flight recalling a rather disreputable vulture more than any angel. Like Carter, Garcia Marquez plays on our notions of wings and flight to explore the situation's ironic possibilities. In fact, he goes even further in some ways. His winged character is literally caged. Moreover, he's dirty and unkempt and bug-ridden, not at all what we expect from potential angels. On one level, the story asks us if we would recognize the second coming if it occurred, and perhaps it reminds us that the Messiah was not generally acknowledged when he did come. The angel doesn't look like an angel, just as the king didn't look like a king, certainly not like the sort of military ruler the Hebrews had expected. Does the old man choose not to fly? Has he been reduced in power and appearance purposely? The story never says, and in its silence, it poses many questions. Of course, his mode of arrival poses another question for us. What about characters who don't quite fly or whose flights are interrupted? Since Icarus, we've had stories of those whose flights end prematurely. In general, this is a bad thing, given what is the opposite of flying. On the other hand, not all crashes end disastrously. At almost the exact same moment, the novels were published within months of each other, Faye Weldon and Salman Rushdie introduced characters, two in each case, falling from great heights from exploding airliners. In Weldon's Hearts and Lives of Men, the contested child of an ugly divorce is kidnapped, and she and her kidnapper float down to safety as the rear section of the plane, containing only the two of them, rather improbably disobeys certain laws of aerodynamics to glide gently to Earth. Rushdie's two main characters, Gabriel and Saladin, fall bodily to the ground, their landing softened by the snow-covered English beach on which they land. In each case, there is an element of rebirth in their cheating what would typically prove to be certain death. The characters are not inevitably better off in their new lives. Rushdie's two are particularly devilish, while Weldon's little girl loses the immense privilege of her previous existence for a very long time, gaining instead the sort of life Dickens would invent for one of his waifs. Nevertheless, the act of falling from vast heights and surviving is as miraculous and as symbolically meaningful as the act of flight itself. As thrilled as we are by the prospect of flying, we are also frightened at the prospect of falling, and anything that seems to defy the inevitability of a plummeting demise sets our imaginations working overtime. The survival of these characters demands that we consider the implications. What does it mean to survive certain death? And how does such survival alter one's relationship to the world? Do the characters' responsibilities to themselves, to life itself, change? Is the survivor even the same person any longer? Rushdie asks outright if birth inevitably involves a fall, while Weldon poses questions that are equally suggestive. If our consideration of flying were limited to those works where characters literally fly, we'd have a pretty thin discussion. These examples of actual flight, necessary as they are, remain valuable chiefly for the instruction they give us in interpreting figurative flight. There's an Irish novel about a little boy growing up to become a writer. As he matures, he finds that in order to acquire the experience and vision he needs to become a writer, he'll have to leave home. Problem, home is an island. The only way he's going to be able to leave is to cross a body of water, which is the most dramatic and final sort of home leaving one can take, and he is a young man with a fear of water. Fortunately, he has the right name to help him out. Daedalus. Not a very Irish name for a young man from Dublin, nor is it the first name he tried for young Stephen, but it's the one James Joyce settled on for A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, 1916. Stephen feels hemmed in by the strictures of Irish life, by family and politics and education and religion and narrow-mindedness. As we know by now, the antidote to limitations and shackles is freedom. The latter parts of the novel are filled with images of birds, feathers, and flying, all of which, while not referring to literal flight, evoke thoughts of metaphorical flight, of escape. Stephen has an epiphany, a Joycean religio-aesthetic word for an awakening, of a waiting girl in which moment he experiences the sensation of beauty and harmony and radiance that convinces him he must be an artist. The girl is neither singularly beautiful nor memorable in herself. Rather, the scene is beautiful in its totality, or perhaps it would be more accurate to say, in his perception of its totality. In this moment, the narration describes her as a bird, from the feathery edges of her drawers to her breast, like that of some dark-plumaged bird. Subsequent to this epiphany, Stephen begins to ruminate on his namesake, the crafter of wings for escape from a different island, whom he comes to think of as hawk-like. Finally, he announces that he must fly past the nets he sees as set to trap him into the conventionality and smallness that is every Dubliner's inheritance. His understanding of flight is purely symbolic, yet his need for escape is no less real for that. In order for him to become a creator, his spirit must soar. He must be free. Indeed, often in literature, the freeing of the spirit is seen in terms of flight. In his poetry, William Butler Yeats often contrasts the freedom of birds with the earthbound cares and woes of humans. In his great The Wild Swans at Cool, 1917, for instance, he watches the beautiful birds rise and wheel, forever young, while he, a middle-aged man, feels the pull of gravity more heavily with each passing year. He makes much of Zeus taking the swan's form to ravish Leda and beget Helen of Troy on her. And he sees the archangel's appearance to the Virgin Mary in terms of wings and birds as well. Similarly, we speak of the soul as taking wing. Seamus Heaney has several poems where the souls of the departed are said to flutter away from the body, and in this he is far from alone. The notion that the disembodied soul is capable of flight is deeply embedded in the Christian tradition, and I suspect in many others as well, although it is not universal. For the ancient Greeks and Romans, such a concept was problematic, since the souls of blessed and damned alike went to an underground realm. But the belief in a celestial heaven leads much of later Western culture to a sense of the soul's lightness. In Birches, Robert Frost imagines climbing the supple birches up toward heaven, then being lightly set back on the ground, and he declares that both going and coming back would be good, even without wings. When Claudius, Hamlet's villainous uncle, tries to pray, he fails, saying, "My words fly up, my thoughts remain below." The spirit cannot rise up, Shakespeare suggests, when weighed down by the guilt of an unconfessed murder. When Hamlet lies dead at the play's end, his friend Horatio mourns him, saying, "Good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest." As we all know by now, if Shakespeare said it, it must be true. These flights of fancy allow us, as readers, to take off, to let our imaginations take flight. We can sail off with characters, freed of the limitations of our tuition payments and mortgage rates. We can soar into interpretation and speculation. Happy landings. Chapter 16. It's All About Sex. There's an ugly rumor circulating that English professors have dirty minds. It's not true, of course. We're no more dirty-minded than society at large, although that may not be of any great comfort. Well, let me assure you that English professors are not innately prurient. It's just that they can recognize the sexual intentions of writers, who may well have dirty minds. So how did all this smutty thinking find its way into world literature? Blame it on Freud. He put it there. More accurately, he found it and showed it to the rest of us. When he published The Interpretation of Dreams in 1900, he unlocked the sexual potential of the subconscious. Tall buildings? Male sexuality. Rolling landscapes? Female sexuality. Stairs? Sexual intercourse. Falling downstairs? Oh my. All of this may be regarded these days as so much hokum in the arena of psychoanalysis, but it's like gold in terms of literary analysis. Suddenly we discover that sex doesn't have to look like sex. Other objects and activities can stand in for sexual organs and sex acts, which is good, since those organs and acts can only be arranged in so many ways and are not inevitably decorous. So landscapes can have a sexual component. So can bowls, fires, seashores, and 1949 Plymouths, one supposes. Virtually anything, if the writer so decides. Oh yes, Freud taught us well. And some of those he taught are writers. Suddenly, as the 20th century gets rolling, two things are happening. Critics and readers are learning that sexuality may be encoded in their reading, while writers are learning that they can encode sexuality into their writing. Headaches, anyone? Of course, the 20th century didn't invent sexual symbolism. Consider the Grail legends. A knight, usually a very young one whose manhood is barely established, sallies forth bearing his lance, which will certainly do until a phallic symbol comes along. The knight becomes the emblem of pure, if untested, maleness in search of a chalice, the Holy Grail, which, if you think about it, is a symbol of female sexuality as understood once upon a time, the empty vessel waiting to be filled. And the reason for seeking to bring together the lance and the chalice? Fertility. Freud gets help here from Jesse L. Weston, Sir James Frazer, and Carl Jung, all of whom explain a great deal about mythic thinking, fertility myths, and archetypes. Typically, the knight rides out from a community that has fallen on hard times. Crops are failing, rains have stopped, livestock and possibly humans are dying or failing to be born. The kingdom is turning into a wasteland. We need to restore fertility and order, says the aging king, too old now to go in search of fertility symbols. Perhaps he can no longer use his lance, so he sends the young man. It isn't wanton or wild sex, but it's still sex. Flash forward a millennium or so. Hang a left at New York and go to Hollywood. There's a moment in The Maltese Falcon, 1941, when Humphrey Bogart, Sam Spade, at night, is leaning over Mary Astor's Bridget O'Shaughnessy, kissing her by a window, and then the next moment, we're looking at the curtains of the window blowing gently in the morning sunlight. No Sam, no Bridget. Young viewers sometimes don't notice those curtains, so they want to know what happened between Sam and Bridget. It may seem a small detail, but it matters greatly that we understand so that we see how much Sam Spade's judgment may be compromised and how difficult turning her in at the end is going to be. For those who remember a time when the movies not only didn't show people doing it, they also didn't show people having done it or talking about having done it. Those curtains might as well bear the following printed legend. Yes, they did, and they enjoyed it. For people of that age, one of the sexiest shots in film consists of waves breaking on a beach. When the director cut to the waves on the beach, somebody was getting lucky. These abstractions were necessary under the Hays Code, which controlled content in Hollywood films from around 1935 until 1965, more or less, throughout the height of the studio system. The Hays Code said a lot of different things, but the one we're interested in was that you could stack bodies like cordwood if they were dead, although usually without blood, but living bodies, couldn't get horizontal together. Husbands and wives were nearly always shown in separate beds. I noticed this once more the other night when I watched Hitchcock's Notorious, 1946, where Claude Rains and Ingrid Bergman have twin beds. The man has never been born who, finding himself married to Ingrid Bergman, would assent to sleeping in twin beds, even an evil Nazi like Claude Rains. But in the movies in 1946, that's what happened. So film directors resorted to anything they could think of. Waves, curtains, campfires, fireworks, you name it. And sometimes the results were dirtier than showing the real thing. At the end of Hitchcock's North by Northwest, 1959, Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint find themselves rescued from the face of Mount Rushmore when the good guys kill Martin Landau before he can send our heroes to their deaths. In one of the truly great cuts, Grant, who is struggling to hold Miss Saint on the rock face, is suddenly pulling her up into the sleeping compartment of the train and referring to her as Mrs. Thornhill. This shot is followed by an equally famous one, the last shot of the film, of the train entering a tunnel. No need to comment on that one. Okay, you say, but that's film. What about books? I barely know where to begin. Let's try something tame first. Anne Beattie's story, Janice, 1985. A youngish woman, married but not particularly in love with her husband, has had an affair with another man, the only tangible result of which is a bull the lover bought for her. The woman, Andrea, comes more and more to identify with the bull and to obsess over it. She's a real estate agent, and she often places the bull in a prominent place in clients' houses before she shows them. She gets up at night to check on it and make sure it's all right. And most tellingly, she will not permit her husband to put his keys in her bowl. Do you see the sexuality embedded in that set of images? How do keys work? Whose keys are they? Where can he not put them? Whose talisman is the bowl he can't put them in? Consider, for instance, that Hank Williams' George Thorogood classic, Move It On Over, and the complaint about his lady changing locks and leaving him with a key that no longer fits. Every American should know enough of the blues to understand exactly what keys and locks signify, and to blush when they're referred to. That pattern of imagery is just part of the much older tradition identified by Freud, Weston, Fraser, Jung, about lances and swords and guns, and keys, as phallic symbols, chalices and grails, and bowls, of course, also, as symbols of female sexual organs. Back to Andrea's bowl. It really is about sex. Specifically, it's about her identity as a woman, an individual, and a sexual being, rather than as an extension of a lover or a husband. She fears being merely an auxiliary of some man's existence, although her autonomy, as symbolized by the bowl, is made problematic by its having been purchased for her by a man. He only buys it, though, after seeing that she really connects with the bowl, so it really is hers in the end. To talk about sex in literature almost inevitably leads to discussion of D.H. Lawrence. The great thing about Lawrence, from my point of view, is that you can never go wrong bringing sex into the analysis. Partly because sex had been taboo for so long and therefore was a largely untapped resource for the novelist, he worked tirelessly to explore the subject. His work has plenty of mentions of sexual relations, some oblique, some explicit. And in his last novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover, 1928, the great forbidden reading fruit of everyone's youth, he pushes right past the limits of censorship of his time. The sexiest scene he ever wrote, though, is not a sex scene. It's wrestling. In Women in Love, the two main male characters wrestle one evening in language in which the sexual charge is ferocious. They've been going on about blood brotherhoods and the closeness of their friendship, so the wrestling is not all that surprising. Lawrence isn't comfortable making them openly homosexual, but he wants a relationship and a physical expression that is nearly as close as the love and sex relationship between man and woman. Ken Russell certainly understood what the scene was about when he filmed the novel back in 1969. I hadn't understood it, being too conditioned not to look for anything homoerotic and, I suppose too insecure as to what that might say about one of my favorite writers. Once I saw the film, though, I went back and reread the scene, and Russell got it right. My favorite Lawrence story, bar none, is called The Rocking Horse Winner, 1932, about a little boy who wants to please his mother. His father is a failure in business, and therefore a great disappointment to the materialist mother. The son, Paul, senses the desperation for money in the house, senses his mother's dissatisfaction, senses the inability of his mother to love him or anyone in the face of her own colossal self-absorption. He connects the lack of his mother's love with a lack of money, then discovers that he can pick the winners of upcoming horse races if he rides his rocking horse to the point of exhaustion. Here's what Lawrence has to say. He wanted luck. He wanted it. He wanted it. When the two girls were playing dolls in the nursery, he would sit on his big rocking horse, charging madly into space with a frenzy that made the little girls peer at him uneasily. Wildly, the horse careered, the waving dark hair of the boy tossed. The eyes had a strange glare in them. The girls dared not speak to them. He knew the horse could take him to where there was luck, if only he forced it. At last he stopped forcing his horse into the mechanical gallop and slid down. Say what you will, I think he's talking about masturbation. When I teach this story, I try to lead the students to this idea without insisting on it. Usually there is one hardy and perceptive soul who gets it and asks, with something between a smirk and a cringe, the question I'm hoping for. One or two others nod, as if they sort of thought that but were afraid to think it through. 35 others look like the ceiling is about to fall. Is it really? Let's look at the pattern that's set up. Child wants to supplant father in his mother's affections. Child desperately wants mother's approval and love. Child engages in highly secretive behavior involving frenetic, rhythmic activity that culminates in transporting loss of consciousness. What does that sound like to you? This is one of the clearest Oedipal situations ever captured in fiction, and for good reason. Lawrence was part of the first generation to read Freud, and so for the first time to consciously employ Freudian thinking in literature. The notion of sublimation kicks in here for both character and writer. Obviously, sexual engagement with the mother is not an option, so Lawrence sends the boy, Paul, in search of the luck his mother desires so terribly. The means of his search is sufficiently creepy that it frightens his pre-sexual sisters and causes consternation among the adults, who feel that he's too big for a rocking horse. Is it really masturbation? Not literally. That would be icky, and not particularly interesting. But symbolically, it fulfills the function of masturbation. Think of it as a surrogate for sex. What could be clearer? Why? Part of the reason for all this disguised sex is that, historically, writers and artists couldn't make much use of the real thing. Lawrence, for instance, had numerous novels suppressed and undertook a monumental battle with the British censors, same as in film. Another reason is that scenes in which sex is coded rather than explicit can work at multiple levels and sometimes be more intense than literal depictions. Those multiple levels have traditionally been to protect innocence. Dickens, who could be very suggestive, was aware that his novels were often read around the family breakfast table, and he wanted to protect children from anything luridly sexual, as well as to provide wives with plausible deniability. With a scene of encoded sex, mother could pretend not to notice that something untoward was going on while father was enjoying his private smirk. There's a scene in Our Mutual Friend, 1865, in which the two villains, Mr. Venus and Silas Wegg, are plotting evil. In fact, Silas Wegg is reading some financial news of a very tantalizing nature to the seated Mr. Venus, whose peg leg begins to rise from the floor until, at the moment of greatest excitement, it is pointing straight out in front of him, and then he falls over. Various family members could see this as either slapstick buffoonery or as quite suggestive slapstick buffoonery. In any case, everybody gets a giggle. Even in our highly permissive age, though, sex often doesn't appear in its own guise. It is displaced into other areas of experience in much the same way it is in our own lives and our own consciousnesses. Anne Beattie's character Andrea doesn't think of her problems as being chiefly sexual or romantic.